Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's local governments are pushing for the ability to re-regulate firearms.
Almost all legislation regarding guns has been preempted by the state legislature, so counties have very little authority to do anything.
Also this week, Florida's U.S. lawmakers weigh in on Facebook's data privacy scandal.
For all of the benefits that Facebook has provided in building communities and connecting families, I think a devil's bargain has been struck.
We'll also get a breaking update on the case of an apparent fraternity hazing death and check out a new account of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis that took the planet closer to the brink of nuclear destruction than most people imagined. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. While state lawmakers made changes this legislative session to improve gun safety following the school shooting in Parkland, local governments are more limited in the steps they can take. Regan McCarthy reports a number of cities and counties are pushing for more legal leeway to increase firearm safety.
We have 135 speakers for the gun show loophole ordinance issue. That is by far the most speaker cards I've seen since I've been on this commission.
County Commission Chair Nick Maddox kicked off a meeting in Leon County during which commissioners listened for more than 5 hours to what turned out to be hundreds of people who came to speak about a county ordinance change that would close the so-called gun show loophole. Commissioner Marianne Lindley pushed for the ordinance change. She brought the issue up during a town hall discussion with local leaders.
Almost all legislation regarding guns has been preempted by the state legislature, so counties have very little authority to do anything. We can do one thing, which is require background registration at gun shows. That is a very narrow little window where a community can act in what it believes it's the best interest for its community.
While the move is often referred to as closing the gun show loophole, it actually extends to all private firearm sales and could include anything from a gun purchased at a gun show to a gun sold at a garage sale or even a gun exchanged in a public parking lot. In Leon County, some commissioners questioned whether they could limit the language to impact gun shows only, but County Attorney Herbert Thiel explained the county is operating within a tight framework.
My recommendation would be to not modify the constitutional language and create any exemptions. I think once you begin to do that, then it's a slippery slope to somebody saying you are regulating firearms differently than that which is authorized in the Constitution.
Despite the county attorney's careful maneuvering, lawsuits from organizations like Florida Carry have already been threatened. Meanwhile, while the Constitution gives the county the ability to make rules regarding firearms in this one instance, a state law prohibits local governments from making rules relating to firearms in most other cases. That law is facing pushback from local governments. A group of communities has joined in a lawsuit claiming the move is unconstitutional. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum explains why.
This law was approved for one reason and one reason only, and that was to chill. Right? Because if you can threaten, and I heard it even in debates that we've had before getting to this point, nobody wants to have to subject themselves to a $10,000 fine or a $100,000 reimbursement of attorney's fees, or to have to go out and find their own lawyers to represent them, or to be subject to removal from office for doing the job that we were elected to do. Right? And it's my hope that this suit will be wildly successful.
During a recent meeting, Tallahassee commissioners voted to join the lawsuit. Gillum says the move only makes sense.
We are, I think, the only municipal government that has actually been sued through the use of this statute. So Tallahassee knows first well, three of us who sit up here today were named in those suits individually. This kind of there are laws which we obviously have to obey, and I believe we have. Obviously, there are just and there are unjust laws, and I think this is an unjust law.
Tallahassee commissioners were faced with a lawsuit after the commission refused to repeal the gun ordinances that were more stringent than state law. The ordinances were essentially null since state law preempted the rules, but commissioners didn't want to remove them from city books. Gillum says at that time the city tried to claim the preemption law was unconstitutional, but the court didn't take up the question. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
This week, members of Congress grilled Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg about a data privacy scandal where millions of Facebook users' data were compromised by a political consultant firm. Sasha Cordner brings us some of the back and forth between Zuckerberg and Florida's U.S. senators and representatives.
During the two-day hearing, members of the U.S. House and Senate peppered Zuckerberg with questions about Facebook from data collection to privacy concerns. Florida Congressman Gus Bilirakis, a Republican, asked Zuckerberg about Facebook ads, particularly ones that may encourage opioid abuse.
This is bad stuff, Mr. Zuckerberg, with regard to the illegal online pharmacies. When are those ads? I mean, when are you going to take those off? I think we need an answer to that.
Congressman, if people flag those ads for us, we will take them down now.
Bilirakis and Zuckerberg then went into a back and forth about the flagging of ads, with Zuckerberg promising he wants to look into a more long-term solution to take those ads down.
We need to be able to build tools that can proactively go out and identify what might be these ads for opioids before people even have to flag them for us to review.
I agree.
Still, the 55-year-old Bilirakis says he appreciates that the social media platform is for people of all ages.
Listen, my family uses Facebook, my friends, my constituents. We all use Facebook. I use Facebook. It's wonderful for our seniors to connect with their relatives.
For all of the benefits that Facebook has provided in building communities and connecting families, I think a devil's bargain has been struck.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor, who had a lengthy exchange with Zuckerberg about Facebook collecting everyone's data, including people who don't have Facebook. Zuckerberg has admitted that Facebook does collect data from non-users for security purposes.
But you're following Facebook users even after they log off of that platform and application. And you are collecting personal information on people who do not even have Facebook accounts. Isn't that right?
Congresswoman, I believe that
yes or no?
Congresswoman, I'm not sure. I don't think that that's what we're tracking.
And Florida's U.S. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, too, had privacy concerns. He sat on the Senate committee that grilled Zuckerberg for hours.
Let me just cut to the chase. If you and other social media companies do not get your act in order, none of us are going to have any privacy anymore. That's what we're facing.
At the crux of the hearings is how 87 million people's personal data may have been compromised for use by a political research firm called Cambridge Analytica, which Nelson asked Zuckerberg about. He told Zuckerberg that when he'd first heard the breach, he should have let those affected know.
When we learned in 2015 that Cambridge Analytica had bought data from an app developer on Facebook that people had shared it with, we did take action. We took down the app, and we demanded that both the app developer and Cambridge Analytica delete and stop using any data that they had. They told us that they did this. In retrospect, it was clearly a mistake to believe them, and yes, we should have followed up and done a full audit then. And that is not a mistake that we will make.
Yes, you did that, and you apologized for it. But you didn't notify them. Do you think that you have an ethical obligation to notify 87 million Facebook users?
Zuckerberg could be facing even more questions from the European Union. He's already admitted that close to 3 million people who are part of the EU may have also been affected by the data scandal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a stunning development in the case of a fraternity pledge death could mean reduced culpability for the frat brothers at the scene when the pledge apparently died of alcohol poisoning.
There's a difference between hazing and somebody who has a binge drinking problem.
Some of the Sunshine State's business leaders are worried about a proposal that may stop them from hiring undocumented workers.
Florida farmers can't handle that kind of uncertainty in the labor force.
The race for Florida Commissioner for Agriculture and Consumer Services is heating up. We'll chat with one of the contenders, Republican State Representative Matt Caldwell. Some of his views differ significantly from many others in his party.
I do believe people that have finished their prison term and have finished their parole or their probation, they ought to be queued up to have their rights restored.
And nearly 56 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a new book is revealing just how close the world came in October of 1962 to nuclear annihilation.
His biggest fear was that things were going to spiral out of his control.
Defense attorneys for two of the nine men charged with felony hazing in the death of Florida State University Pi Kappa Phi pledge Andrew Coffey say they have evidence that could potentially upend the prosecution's case. We get this exclusive report from Ryan Daly.
Photos and text messages pulled from Andrew Coffey's cell phone, along with statements from his former roommate, are just some of the evidence that defense attorneys are saying is a major development in the felony hazing case that rocked Florida State University. Cell phone photos show the late 20-year-old passed out on the floor of an apartment. In the photo, a Pi Kappa Phi fraternity brother stands above Coffey giving a thumbs up. That photo accompanies several others depicting Coffey with friends and fraternity members, each drinking entire pitchers of beer. They are just part of what defense lawyers for two of the nine men facing trial say is explosive new evidence. Along with photos are text messages taken from Coffey's phone, which show he was setting up the purchase of amphetamine drug Adderall. Attorney Don Pumphrey represents fraternity member Luke Klutz. He says the prosecution has been misled about Andrew Coffey's past with drinking.
I don't believe the elected state attorney had knowledge based upon what the family had given him and law enforcement that this young man had a binge drinking problem.
Coffey's former high school classmate and roommate while attending Florida State University, Kelsey Lund, was questioned by defense attorneys in front of the state attorney this week. Pumphrey says information that came forward during Lund's deposition points to a pattern of heavy drinking before becoming a pledge, as far back as high school. According to Pumphrey, Lund claims he knew of a conversation between Coffey and his mother, indicating she was concerned about Coffey's developing drinking problem.
We also have sworn testimony from Kelsey Lund, who was his best friend and roommate, that his mother was very concerned with his serious drinking problem.
Brian Tannenbaum is the attorney for Anthony Pettigini, another of the nine defendants. He says the information put forward in Lund's deposition is explosive.
What we have here is a situation where the grand jury was told that Andrew Coffey had no prior history of substance abuse. Now, even with knowing that, they chose not to charge anybody in this case with any criminal offenses. This was done by the state attorney. And what I found interesting is that I was at the deposition of Mr. Lundy, where he walked in and was introduced for the first time to the state attorney.
Second Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell in March offered plea deals to the nine defendants, which was outed by a public records request by the Tallahassee Democrat. The deals would see the nine men plead down to misdemeanor charges. They would serve 60 days in either jail or a jail work camp, followed by probation. Tannenbaum says the evidence that has surfaced this week may cause some defendants to reconsider.
If I was a defendant considering taking a plea and I learned of this, I would reconsider going in and taking a plea.
Meanwhile, Tannenbaum likens the case to the bogus allegations made in 2006 against members of the Duke lacrosse team, which led to a highly publicized rape trial.
I believe this is the Duke lacrosse case of Tallahassee. I believe that these nine defendants did nothing criminal.
The alleged conversation between Coffey and his mother stands in contrast to written answers given by Coffey's parents to interrogatories filed this week in their civil lawsuit against Pi Kappa Phi. Asked if they knew of any prior incidents where their son had passed out or thrown up from drinking, Coffey's parents said they knew of none. In their civil suit, the Coffey family claims the fraternity's culture of hazing led to Andrew Coffey's death. David Bianchi is the attorney representing the Coffey family in that civil case. He says the defense is using a tactic he feels is common when a victim is involved.
This is nothing more than what we see every time the defense needs to come up with some excuse for what they did. They try to blame the victim.
Meanwhile, State Attorney Jack Campbell, when asked about the new evidence, said he would not discuss the case. After being contacted for comment, Campbell has filed a gag order prohibiting the defense from talking about facts of the case to media or others pre-trial. A hearing is scheduled for Monday when several of the defendants are expected to enter their pleas. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida Republican Representative Matt Caldwell wants to be the state's next agriculture commissioner. To get there, he's got to defeat six other candidates, including Republican Senator Denise Grimsley. Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter caught up with Caldwell as he was heading from Naples to Jacksonville. They spoke by phone on everything from trade wars to clemency.
Representative, thank you so much for joining us here today. You are running for state agriculture commissioner, and I think the first question that I have is why? Why that job, and why try and go for it now?
Absolutely. Well, part of it, you have to understand just my background and passion about Florida. So my mom's side of the family's been in Florida nearly 200 years. They came into Micanopy in 1826, and so just having that background, that understanding, that the education, just coming up as a young man, about just how unique and special Florida really is, that informed a lot of my decision to get involved in politics at all. And I started volunteering when I was in college. One thing leads to another, and ended up running for the House 8 years ago in 2010. And when you get to the House, and that was a hard-fought grassroots campaign, but we got to the House, and they ask you, what do you want to work on? And my number one choice was ag and natural resources. I'd been outspoken as a volunteer on Everglades issues and water issues in Southwest Florida, and thought, you know, that was a nice natural fit. And here we are 8 years later. I've had the blessing and opportunity to chair the not only the subcommittee but the full committee for the last 4 years, and really get a front row seat, work with the current commissioner, Adam Putnam, on pretty much everything that goes through that department, environmental issues and water policy issues, Everglades issues, and state lands policy. And this is a fantastic opportunity to continue to work on those things that I'm passionate about, the things that I think are so critical for Florida and its future.
Florida farmers have been dealing with this issue of citrus greening now for the past 15 years, and we've seen the state's sort of hallmark crop basically go down by about 80% within that same time frame. Now you have increasing conversations regarding the potential for tariffs on not only citrus, but strawberries and peanuts, which is a crop here in North Florida. Are farmers raising these issues to you, and what are you telling them about how to proceed in the current climate?
Florida occupies a really unique spot in the country. You know, we have somewhere north of 300 different ag products that we grow or raise. And you compare that to most states in the Midwest, for example, they might have a big three, you know, pigs, corn, soybeans is what they're focused on. The diversity of what we deal with here makes it a very unique question because, as you say, in North Florida, you're going to have more traditional crops, cotton, peanuts, things like that. You get to the center of the state, cattle industry and the citrus industry, and then you come down to the south end in Dade County and the variety of tropical fruits and vegetables and landscape plants makes for an interesting mix. And each of those compete in different ways in the international market. You know, right now we are the hub for Central and South America for the production of ag products that they are shipping into this country. You look at something like cut flowers. You know, if you buy a bouquet of flowers anywhere in the United States, 90% chance those flowers came through Miami International Airport. Really an incredible amount of activity and business that comes through there. So, you know, I think it's going to be a keen responsibility of the commissioner to be involved in those negotiations and those discussions.
You know, as we're talking now, Florida has been effectively ordered to rewrite its clemency rules by a federal judge. And I'm wondering, you know, what is your approach to clemency?
I do believe people that have finished their prison term and have finished their parole or their probation they ought to be queued up to have their rights restored. Now, I would separate between violent felons and nonviolent crimes. Essentially, in my Matt Caldwell's perfect world, if you committed a nonviolent felony and you went, finished your prison term, you went, finished your probation, your name should automatically go on the list for the cabinet to bring up. And the only reason that you wouldn't get your rights restored is if one of the cabinet members pulled the name off and would have to give a reason to the other cabinet members why this individual didn't deserve that. Honestly, if you've done the time that we've said should provide rehabilitation and restitution to society, you've then gone out and completed your probation and demonstrated that you're not likely to reoffend, that you have actually been rehabilitated, you should have your rights restored and you should be able to rejoin civil society. And I would certainly want to see the Clemency Board operate that way if I had an opportunity to weigh in on it.
Well, Representative Caldwell, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for the chance.
That's Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with Republican State Representative Matt Caldwell. He's running for Florida Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Florida's medicinal marijuana industry has had a newsworthy week with lawsuits, court cases, and administrative complaints. To cap off this eventful week, the Department of Health held another marijuana workshop today, which focused on packaging, labeling, and waste management.
The Florida Department of Health's workshop on medicinal marijuana packaging and labeling was open for public comments. The director of the Florida Department of Health's medical marijuana program, Christian Bax, explained what information must be legally present on packaging.
Statute, the name of the medical marijuana treatment center from which the marijuana originates, the batch number and harvest number from which the marijuana originates and the date dispensed, the name of the physician who issued the physician certification, the name of the patient, the product name, if applicable, and dosage form, including concentration of THC and CBD. The product name may not contain wording commonly associated with products marketed by or to children, the recommended dose, a warning that it is legal to transfer medical marijuana to another person, and a marijuana universal symbol developed by the department.
Jody James of Florida Cannabis Action Network raised some concerns over packaging what she sees as a harmless drug.
Our concern almost becomes the other direction, and that is waste. A lot of our people are trying to be environmentally friendly. And so all of these boxes, the box that's inside the box that's inside the box that's inside the plastic container, ultimately ends up being an awful lot of waste.
Meanwhile, in Tampa, a 77-year-old strip club owner with stage 4 lung cancer won a case against the state over owning his own marijuana plant. His attorney argued that a voter-approved constitutional amendment allowed Joe Redner to follow a doctor's recommendation of juicing the entire marijuana plant in order to treat his cancer that is in remission. At the same time, Trulieve, a marijuana provider with 13 dispensaries in Florida, has filed a lawsuit against the state's dispensary cap. A 2017 law allows only 25 dispensaries across the state, which Trulieve argues is arbitrary and contradicts the state-approved licenses already distributed to several business owners. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ange Quintana.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, there were plenty of times during the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union that the two nations nearly came to blows, but none seemed to bring the sides closer to the brink of total annihilation as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And a Floridian named Michael Tagayas has written a new book about it called Above and Beyond.
In 1962, the Soviets started to bring in military equipment onto the island of Cuba to support Castro, and this was shortly after the Bay of Pigs that the U.S. had backed that failed invasion.
So tensions were already high, but U.S. intelligence didn't know for sure if the Soviet weapons were for offense or defense. So Tagayas says it was time to take to the skies in high-flying U-2 spy planes.
We sent these over Cuba to get the pictures to find out what is going on. And on October 14th, 1962, that mission uncovered the fact that the Soviets had installed medium-range ballistic missiles.
The North Florida coastal hometown of that mission pilot was the first of many Sunshine State connections to the crisis.
Apalachicola, of course, was the home of U-2 pilot Steve Heiser, and he's the one who first discovered the missiles.
DeGaia says Florida military installations played a major role throughout.
The U-2s, they were all based at McCoy Air Base in Orlando. And then we had a series of other surveillance planes that were not U-2s. They were called Navy Crusaders, and they were very low-level reconnaissance planes. And they were all based out of Key West.
Even the President of the United States had a connection to Florida.
You have Palm Beach, where JFK had his nuclear bunker when he'd be down there vacationing. He even suggested to the Air Force, he said, you may want to spread out your planes from just the military bases, and I suggest you put some at the Palm Beach Airport so they're not sitting ducks. And they took him up on that.
Of course, Palm Beach International is where Air Force One lands nowadays when President Trump visits his nearby Mar-a-Lago estate. But back in 1962, Tagaya says Trump's predecessor was wrestling with a decision that could lead to the literal end of the world.
Kennedy was under such pressure to take action, to take military action, and it really took a strong person to withstand the bulk of your advisors saying, we need to do something, and we need to do something now. And he kept putting it off. He knew that he had a little bit of window before these nuclear warheads would go on top of all the missiles.
Meanwhile, in Moscow, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was also seeing the situation deteriorate. Tagaya says he learned this by interviewing the Russian leader's son, Sergei, who lives today in the United States.
In Above and Beyond, one of the main scenes in the book is the shootdown of one of our spy planes. He said his father felt that things were spiraling out of control when that happened, because he did not give authorization for that shootdown. And I remember saying to Sergei Khrushchev, you use the exact same words that Kennedy used. His biggest fear was that things were going to spiral out of his control.
Fast forward nearly 56 years, and Tagaya says there is a vital lesson for today's world leaders.
Never let it even get that far. When you come that far down the road of the military buildup, it gets away from the two people who think they're in control, and people at lower levels who might have different agendas begin to influence their power.
Above and Beyond, a new, very Florida-centric recounting of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis by Floridian Michael Tagayas. Available everywhere April 17th. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Andrew Quintana and Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.